what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Sebastian Scale Show. This is a fun one. This is a wild synchronistic sequence that spans, well, decades, I guess. Hope you're doing great, by the way. Thanks for tuning back in. About a year ago, I got reached out to by someone from the Children's Advocacy Centers of Illinois about a conference that happens every year. And they asked me if I wanted to be the keynote speaker of the conference, the opening keynote speaker. They have one at the beginning. It's like a 3-day conference, and then one at the end. And I remember being like, yeah, of course, so down. That would be awesome. And I said, yes, immediately, sure. And then they were like, okay, great. It'll be an hour and 15 minutes of you speaking and then a 15-minute Q&A. And I was like, oh, wow, dude, that is so much longer than I've ever been on stage for. But just like we talked about in the episode about doing that long stand-up set and what song was it? Jason Mraz. Oh, The Remedy. Just like that sequence, you know, maybe this opportunity is here because I'm ready for it and not because I need to shut it down out of fear, you know, like stepping into that space of this is happening to you because you're ready. And it's new and it's unfamiliar, and that's why your brain tries to battle you into not doing it. But no matter what your brain says, you don't have to listen to it. You actually never have to listen to your brain if you don't want to, which is so, so important if you have a brain like mine tends to be sometimes. That's just, here's everything that could possibly go wrong with everyone that you've ever met in your entire life. And it's important to remember that you don't always have to take everything your brain thinks as a fact. And it feels so good to just think of, you know, as I'm moving into this experience, being like, oh yeah, this is happening because I'm ready for it. Immediately transforms the entire sequence of preparation and leading up to it. I remember feeling like, oh man, I could do this right now. That Remedy set was the longest set I'd ever done, which was 30 minutes. And even that seemed wild at the time. So this speech was going to be 2.5 times that. But I don't know, in that space of belief that I am ready, even if I haven't done something like this before, you know, it's like, okay, well, this is going to be great. It's not going to be like fine. It's not going to be bad. It's going to be great. And I think as you maintain that headspace, solutions appear that may not have popped up or you may not have seen in the space of this is bad. This is not going to work out. I'm not ready. Feels like vibrationally, you just continue to see more of what it is that you believe reality to be. If you have the lens of I am not ready, you will continue to see evidence of reasons that support that belief. And this whole sequence just totally confirmed that for me because, you know, literally, I think I found out about this 11 months ago and I didn't even really start prepping until like a few weeks before. And I think that's just because I knew, like, you know, it's going to be fine. It's going to be awesome. So when I did start prepping, you know, I started to realize, like, I have never talked about the molestation or anything really on stage in a non-comedic way, like a strictly stand-up platform type of performance. And I was realizing, like, oh, there is going to be so much stuff in this speech that does not elicit laughter. I think elicit is the right word. evoke. It does not evoke laughter. There's lots of unfunny stuff that's going to happen in this speech. And I was just thinking to myself, I am going to have to be like super aware of the fact that I'm not bombing. Just because people aren't laughing does not mean I'm bombing. You know, because normally in a stand-up format, you're only like really appropriate, not appropriate, but like the only gauge of like how things are going is whether or not people are laughing. That's sort of like the only response that you're really going for. So I was thinking to myself, like, oh man, this could be long extended periods of not having laughter, which could have been scary and uncomfortable and whatever. But again, through this lens of this is going to be great. I don't even have to know why yet, but I know it's going to be great because, well, you don't even have to explain it because I've done this enough now to know that I prefer to go through life with the lens of things are working out because it feels better and more fun things happen. So I kept that belief operating system, and then it was like immediately, like as my brain, even as my brain would, you know, through the momentum of the past and habit patterns of the mind, pop up different things that could be bad, like what if it feels like I'm bombing? Immediately, like, you know, the lens sort of colors the thought into, like, or morphs the thought into, or provides a solution to the thought, which is like, there's so much that I want to say and talk about on stage that isn't funny. Like, and I absolutely love stand-up. It's not that they're mutually exclusive. It's just that this is the first opportunity that I've had to talk about things like the trial and like really what was going on in the molestation and like going to therapy, like all these things that have humorous elements in them, but what a freeing feeling to not have to present them in a way that makes people laugh and to have humor be, you know, an awesome bonus instead of like the entire thing that you're leaning on. And through that lens, it was like, wow, this is an amazing opportunity that I am really excited for, even if I haven't done it yet. So when I was prepping, initially what my plan was to basically memorize the whole thing. I mean, for all of my stand-up sets, you know, I basically memorize it word for word down to the timing and all of that. And recently what I've been getting into more is the space of not having it perfectly laid out word for word and getting into audience interactions, connecting with people, trusting that it doesn't have to go exactly the way that I've decided would be optimal in order for it to be optimal, and opening up to just like whatever is actually happening in the moment. And it's so expansive. Obviously, this is not limited to stand-up. It could be anything in any moment, but just going with the flow would be another way of saying it. So I noticed as I would start writing things down about that I wanted to say, and I would start like trying to memorize it, it felt so strenuous and tightening and heavy and like just difficult. I mean, I couldn't believe like how hard it was to even memorize, like, just, you know, I've been doing so much of my stand-up material for so long now that I have it down, but like memorizing new stuff. And it was frustrating when I would go through it and I would forget to say certain things. And then I had a conversation with my dad, and he speaks at a lot of conferences and about different things. But you know, he talks about how now it's basically at this point where he doesn't really plan out anything because he knows the information. And, you know, he has a PowerPoint, and the PowerPoint guides him through, you know, to make sure that the overarching themes are all hit on. But, you know, you really don't have to memorize it word for word because you know it. And as I opened up to that possibility, like, oh my God, what would it really be like if I got on stage for this conference and just shared my story without needing to ensure that I say it in a specific way, And oh my God, dude, it was like all of that tension dissolved. All of it was released. The backpack that I was holding on to of like, I gotta hit everything, just dropped it. And I was like filled with excitement. And the whole prepping period felt like fun. And I would, you know, more focus on like, okay, like, what are the topics that I want to cover rather than like, what are the words that I need to say? Because at the end of the day, like I'm telling my story, I'm saying what happened to me, and nobody's going to fact check me on that. Nobody's going to say that I missed a thing or whatever. Like they're hearing it for the first time. So what a relief to not have to just like make sure I don't forget anything, which will come in later, the significance of that. So I planned everything out, and I basically was like, okay, I'm going to hit on the first thing I'm going to talk about is like feelings, things that we've talked about in this podcast about, you know, how not feeling feelings is like not smelling smells. You know, if there's a smell that you don't like, you can plug your nose and then you can't smell that smell, but you also can't smell anything else. And how the same thing goes for feelings. When you have a feeling that you don't like and you resist, you suppress that feeling. And you also suppress every feeling because you are suppressing your ability to feel. By not allowing that feeling to flow, you restrict the flow of feelings in your body and ultimately restrict happiness. By resisting sadness, you resist happiness. And so the theme of the whole speech was how what we need to do is feel. That's the way that we heal from what's happened to us. And so I started off with that, and then I talked about the molestation, and then I talked about the trial, and then I was going to talk about all of these things, and then, you know, stand up, go into therapy, and then sort of tie it up, you know, in a bow. As I was getting ready for the trial section of the speech, for this short film that I was working on, actually for the remedy sequence, that whole film, which is, we're going to be premiering it, I think on April 6th. So I will keep you guys posted on details about that. But I had reached out to the courthouse where we went to trial, and I asked them if they had any like documentation or audio recordings from the trial. And they did, amazingly. This lady was so helpful. And she was, I told her about what I was doing and stuff. And she was like, that's awesome. Like, here's all the files that we have. And she sent me the audio from my testimony. And I got this audio, and I've had it for a while, and I've gone through it a couple of times, but not like, you know, every part of it, but I had gone through it in the past. But there was something about this time when I was going through it that I don't know exactly why, but this time it affected me so much differently. Like I was listening to the defense attorney asking me questions, and, you know, like he asked me, you know, for every molestation instance, which this went on over a period of 2 years, so there's a lot of them. And for every one I would have to answer, he would ask me, what was the date? What time was it in the morning? Like, it would always happen, wake up, you know, and my friend's dad would, I call him Jim, would be molesting me. And I would, you know, wake up, and he would ask me, so like, how long had you been sleeping for? It's like, dude, I don't know. What do you mean? They have apps for that now, because nobody has any idea when they wake up how long they've been sleeping for. And then he would ask me, you know, like, how long did each molestation instance go on for? At one point he asked me, he was like, we established that I would roll over and that would get Jim to stop. And so there's a point where the defense attorney asks me, so one night you saw Jim coming into the room, and you didn't roll over. when you saw him coming into the room? And I was like, no, because he hadn't touched my penis yet. And then the defense attorney goes, oh, okay, well, let me go back for a second. You're a good student, right? And I go, yeah. And he goes, you get like A's and B's, 3s and 4s was the grading system at the time because I was in 5th grade or whatever. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, so you're a good student, so you must have known that Jim was coming into the room to molest you, right? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, but you didn't roll over. And I was like, no, because he hadn't touched me yet. And the defense attorney just goes, like as if he's proved to the jury that like, I don't, it's like the most absurd line of questioning ever. You're like, wait, is this, are you smarter than a 5th grader? Like for fucking molestation? Absolutely insane line of questioning that also doesn't even prove anything. Like he's trying to be like, you were smart, but you didn't do that. That's interesting. As if, what does that even conclude? Like, regardless of when I rolled over, it's molestation. And regardless of whether or not I get good grades or not, it's molestation. But he frames it in such an insane way to be like, you know, it also doesn't even make sense. I'm saying as my 11-year-old self, like he did not, had not touched me yet. So I didn't roll over. If I rolled over beforehand, I would have to roll over again because rolling over beforehand wouldn't do anything. He's not touching me yet. But there were like instance after instance, like of this absurd questioning that I had to go through. And like he would pull out, I had to do a pretrial interview with the defense attorney where they had a transcript of all the questions that he asked me and the prosecuting attorney. And so he would ask me the same questions when I was on the stand. Like, for example, what date did a specific molestation instance occur on? And if I got that question wrong, if I didn't know the date during the trial, he would pull the transcript out and make me read it out to the jury. He would ask me the same question and make me read my answer, which was, you know, yes when I would say no, or no when I would say yes, or September 30th was like the date that he kept harping on. He was like, you knew the date when I asked you about this in the trial pre-interview, but you don't know it now. Interesting. So like all of this stuff, all these instances of, I mean, basically child abuse, it's professional child manipulation, emotional manipulation, psychological manipulation, all this stuff. And when I was going through it and listening, I felt like a lot of tension in my belly, in my chest. What I felt as I kind of sat with it was like anger. I felt like rage. And it was just something that I hadn't really dealt with before. Like, I remember, you know, throughout all of this, ever since I started doing stand-up, and like going to therapy and stuff, I never really did any work with anger. It's not something that I really felt angry about. It's more like I felt sad and helpless and more emotions that were not really like aggressive or angry. So I was feeling all of this, and this was literally the week before the conference happened. And so on that weekend before the conference, so I guess it was 2 weekends before the conference. Also, by the way, this is, it's so funny now, like after listening to the trial audio and being like, oh, dude, this is so much of why I'm paranoid about different things, you know, like what I over explain myself when it comes to just explanations of things and almost in anticipation of questioning, in anticipation of being criticized and ridiculed and, you know, shamed publicly for getting things wrong. You know, my brain has developed these tendencies to hyper overthink because, you know, a lot of the trial felt to me like life or death type situations. It's very infused with primal survival mechanisms. And so anyway, all this stuff that I've been, you know, working on for many years. And but anyway, so 2 weekends before the conference happened, my therapist, Christine, who passed away about a year ago, her son, who I met at her memorial, his name is Tobin. Tobin was coming to LA, and he was with his partner, and they texted me, and we were planning on hanging out. We all totally hit it off at the memorial, and so they came to town, and we went on this big hike over the weekend, and I was talking to them about all this stuff, and it was really awesome and helpful, and it was so cool because Tobin, a lot of the stuff that I'm talking, that I went on to talk about in the conference, was about doing EMDR and working with Christine and all these things that I hadn't talked to him about yet. So after the hike, when the next day I was working, I was going through the transcript, the audio of the trial, and that's when I started feeling all of this rage. And so the next day, they were leaving, and I took them to the airport, and I told Tobin about this, what had been happening with this rage feeling and stuff. And he asked me if his mom, Christine, had ever done any sort of rage release work with me. And I told him the same thing about, like, no, we, like, never really did. She asked me that stuff, and you know, she said, you can, when we were doing EMDR, you can do anything that you want to the guy who molested you. There's no shame. There's no problems. You behave in whatever way you want to behave to get all of these emotions out. And I didn't feel like any anger towards him at all. I just wanted it to stop. But this trial sequence just affected me so differently. And so I told him no. And he ended up telling me that what he did with his mom and what his mom would recommend in these situations is that you do things to get the energy out, including hitting pillows, screaming into pillows, and jumping jacks. Those are like the three things that he recommended. And so I dropped them off at the airport, and then I went home and started going through the transcript again. And it was like just even more rage. It was like every question that I heard from the defense attorney, I felt like so much anger. And so I started doing this stuff. I was like, I remember going out to the beach, and also like I felt frustrated. I felt frustrated that I was feeling all of this despite all the healing that I've done. I was sort of almost like upset with myself for still having these these feelings come up. And so I went out to the beach, and I was doing jumping jacks on the beach, and I was listening to, like, you know, angsty teenage music and just like dancing super hard and, like, you know, just kind of moving the energy around. And then I remember getting back, and I took a pillow, and I just started wailing on it. And I remember while I was punching the pillow, realizing that I've never thrown a punch before. It's like, I'm 28 years old, and I mean, fortunately, I'm lucky to not have, but it was so interesting doing this motion, just like two-hand, like hammer fisting the pillow, and then, like, you know, regular punches, and just realizing, like, oh my God, I haven't even done this act before. I haven't moved my body in this way before. And it felt really, really good. And I would throw punches until I exhausted myself, and then I would take the pillow and scream into it. And I remember at one point imagining the defense attorney's face on the pillow. And as I was punching it, I was kind of like, that actually doesn't do it for me, because I'm not even, I mean, I'm mad at him, but I think really this is just about, I just want to get this out. I don't want to take it out on anyone. I just want to release this. And then I went back to just sort of feeling the emotions and then whacking the pillow. And then I would, and then I also mixed in more jumping jacks. It was like just this wild, you know, workout circuit of rage release. And after a while, it was like I ran out of energy, and it felt amazing. And I sat down after that, and I remember sort of thinking about the speech and how, you know, the underlying theme of it is that like every emotion is good because it deepens your capacity to feel. So in the same way that resisting anger and sadness, or just whatever emotion you define as negative or that you want to resist, resisting any emotion is resisting the emotions that you love and want to feel. And thinking about that in the context of this rage, it was like, again, this lens shift of my reality from frustration for still feeling this way to like gratitude for the fact that I'm able to feel this, like this new emotion. I mean, I don't know if I've felt rage in that way before or allowed myself to feel that rage before. And sort of recognizing that like, oh, this is, dude, this is literally deepening my ability to feel happiness. This is expanding my ability to feel as a human and thus, you know, feeling more. And that lens shift alone made the entire experience shift. It was just in a second, you know, all of that resistance to like, why am I still you know, hurting, just shifted to what a brilliant opportunity this is. And think of how good things are already and just how much better they're going to continue to get. How much more I'm going to be able to feel. And also like it just instantly changed my experience with the feelings that I was having. Like unresisted emotion is an entirely different experience than resisting emotion, whatever the emotion is that you're resisting. Like if you have sadness and you're fighting it and you have all of that tension and it's storing in your body because you don't want to feel this heaviness, that is like sadness combined with all of this, you know, hodgepodge of egoic resistance. And if all of that resistance is gone and what you have is sadness, just sort of pure sadness, that experience of feeling that sadness is it's like magical. It's like every feeling, you know, it's like, wow, this is what is happening in my experience right now as a human being. I'm experiencing the feeling of sadness, and it doesn't even really feel bad. It's like it doesn't even feel like negative at all. If you drop the thoughts and the lens that we, so many of us have had on for all of our lives that, or most of our lives, that tells us that sadness is bad and weak and vulnerable. And if you change your perception of the feelings that you're having, the experience of having those feelings changes. And that's totally what happened. It felt like, oh man, dude, this rage is a gift. And I'm so glad to be at a point where I can allow it and have an outlet for it that totally worked for me. And dude, the timing of Tobin and his partner showing up, like, I mean, I haven't seen Tobin since the memorial, like, yeah, like 10 months ago. May 11th, 2023 at 4:10 p.m. Like that, literally that for so long there was, and on some level, hopefully less than ever, but it was like my body is like anticipating people doing the type of stuff that the defense attorney did. And you know, one part of this too is how, like, if when you resist an emotion, it stores in your body and it doesn't leave your body until you allow yourself to feel it. Feeling is the avenue through which your body processes these emotions. And if you restrict that processing, you don't allow them to be released and they stay in your body, which is basically like the feeling that originated at some point in the past is like part, it's like your body is this backpack that you're carrying around. All these instances of moments that happened that you didn't want to feel, so you resisted them and then they stored in your body. You know, it's like you're carrying around the past in the form of resisted emotion. And so feeling that rage that I didn't even know was dormant in me, and, you know, the gift of the audio from the trial, I mean, what an opportunity. Triggering is so negatively viewed by in our society, and yet triggering is like the ultimate gift from you to you, sometimes from others to you. It's showing you that you have unprocessed emotion within you. You have unhealed parts of yourself that are right at the surface and ready to be healed and felt. And if you can allow it and allow all of it to come out, come up, you release your ties to that part of the past. It's like there was like an energetic cord going all the way back to when I was 11 in the trial and having those experiences that I've been lugging around in the form of suppressed rage, among other emotions, that if you, as you feel it, you know, that cord is released. And then you're just, you're lighter. And one of the things I talked about in the conference was like all of that energy that you were putting into suppressing those emotions flows back into your experience. It flows back into now. And you, this is part of why you feel things so much more intensely when you're not resisting, because all of the energy that you were putting into not feeling now is available for you to feel and do anything else, whatever else it is that you want to do. Most of us are like unconsciously putting in vast amounts of energy into the suppression of emotions that also like results in all sorts of like diseases and things. And like, I saw some article the other day that like suppressed anger is like a bleeding, like four times is your, what was the phrase? Increases your risk of cancer by four times or something like that. And I guess, you know, it makes sense. Not necessarily, I don't fully understand why, but conceptually, putting energy into resisting the natural movement of energy in your body, which is what emotions are. It's energy and motion flowing through your body. Resisting that is resisting your body's operating system. So of course it's going to cause problems. And, you know, not to say this in a way to induce worry, like, you know, an older version of myself would have been like, fuck, did I repress this anger for too long? And now I'm going to get blah, you know, I'm going to be sick or whatever. It's like, no, this is absolutely perfect timing. Anytime that you realize you have more suppressed emotion and you allow it to come up, it's perfect. You don't have to dwell on the fact that you've been suppressing it for so long and why didn't you do this sooner? You did it at the perfect time for you to feel it. So there doesn't have to be any regret about, why didn't I do this back then? It's like you weren't ready then, you know? I've been doing all this stuff with Christine and stand up, all these things, like years and years of talking about this, and only now did this rage come up. And I'm so glad that it did. So anyway, yeah, releasing your ties of the past brings you back into now, and you can go infinitely into now. There's no limit to the amount of intensity that you can experience this moment with, other than the limits that you put on yourselves by resisting it. And all of these shifts just, you know, very quickly happening with this rage sequence. It just felt amazing. And then looking at it like, oh my God, I happened to bump into the one person, you know, who I'm like actively in contact with, from who's, you know, the son of my therapist who changed my life, unfathomably positively, happened to relay the information that she would have given me to process this sequence that was coming up, even after she's passed on and death, whatever that means, you know, her energy has just transformed into something else. But the timing, literally, I see him, we go on this hike, I start feeling all this rage the next day, and then I take him to the airport, just a 15, 20 minute conversation to the airport, and he's like, hey, do this stuff. And it like perfectly worked. It's just classic, perfect unfolding. And it gets better. So, I mean, it always gets better, dude. I mean, well, it always gets better, or whatever it is that you believe it to get, you know, whatever lens you want to have on. So, about 2 weeks before that, Galen and I have been getting really into Pokemon cards, as evidence in the background here. We both liked Pokemon growing up, and we've been getting back into it more. And it's just been so fun. And so we've been, you know, buying packs, collecting cards. And out of nowhere, one night she asked me what my favorite Pokemon is. And I thought about it for a moment and then definitively was like Lugia. Which, for those of you that don't know, Lugia is like, he's the beast of the sea. He's like the protector of the elements. And in the second Pokemon movie, Pokemon 2000, he is the Lugia. He speaks English and he's got this awesome voice. And after I told her Lugia, I started looking up clips of the movie Pokemon 2000. And I started feeling emotional just like hearing Lugia speak. And, you know, this was right around the time of, you know, when I was a kid and going through all of this stuff. And so I think it was just putting me back in that sort of headspace and remembering these feelings that I had watching this movie that I hadn't felt in forever. And I got a bit emotional, and immediately I went on eBay and ordered a Japanese Lugia, the first Lugia card that came out. And I also ordered, we were looking through all the different Lugias, and there was a custom Lugia card. Not a real Pokemon card, but just designed by an artist that likes Lugia. And it was just so sick. It was like this awesome, you know, card. So Lugia was also a Cormorant, which I don't even know if I put that episode out yet, but I will put it out. Anyway, I ordered that card too, the custom card. And so the Japanese Lugia came very quickly. I have it here. The Japanese Lugia came like a few days later. I'll pop it up on the screen. If you can't see it, but came a few days later, and it's so sick. Absolutely love this card. And then Galen came over that night, like about probably an hour after I had this huge rage release. And when she was over, I was telling her all about this sequence, and I talked to my mom right before Galen got there, and we were talking about lots of different other stuff. And then she was like, so how are other things going? And I was like, good. I just had this major rage release, but Galen just got here. I need to let her in. I'll call you back another time. So Galen comes in. We're talking about this stuff. And then I get a notification on from my email from eBay saying that the Lugia has been delivered. And I got it. I went and got it. And it's this absolutely incredibly beautiful card. I'll pop it up on the screen again. And as we're talking through all of this stuff, I was talking to Galen about the rage. And then I was like, oh, I need to call my mom back. Like, I should include her in this because we were just talking about this. So I've got my mom on FaceTime and Galen's there. And by the way, I had told my parents about this Lugia sequence because when I was watching the clips of Pokemon 2000, part of what I got emotional about was I was remembering how Ash is the main character in Pokemon. And for all of my childhood, everyone called me Bash. And I had never made that connection before, but it's just obviously rhymes and is so close, bash and ash. but anyway, so we were talking about, when I called my parents and told them about this Lugia sequence, I just got emotional on the phone there too. And so my mom, it's a little convoluted, but I'll tie it together. So my mom understood the Lugia sequence, and I showed them the card that had just arrived. Literally like minutes after Galen arrived, I got the notification that Lugia had been dropped off. So Lugia, Pokemon cards have like attacks. They generally have one or two attacks. And the first attack on this Lugia card from a custom artist that did not, this is not affiliated with Pokemon. This is just the attack that she gave Lugia is called Rage Wave. And so we read that, and immediately, this is after I like told them about, you know, the whole rage sequence that I just had, and rage was the word. Rage was the emotion that I was feeling and expressing, and how, like, we were literally describing it like emotions as waves and allowing them to crash. And imagine the impact of the ocean resisting an emotion, an emotion. The emotion, the ocean of emotion that we all feel. Imagine if the ocean was trying to get the wave to not go in a certain direction, to not be felt. And then obviously the ocean never resists a wave. And so the waves can go wherever they need to go and then crash on the beach or wherever it is. And then all of that it's like the crashing of the wave is like the feeling. And then as you feel, the wave crashes, and then all of the energy of the wave comes back into the ocean. And I'm going to sneeze. Woohoo! So right away, it was like the timing of this Lugia being delivered, like literally moments after this whole rage sequence, as I'm talking to my mom and Galen, who both know the Lugia sequence, and we see this, and this is, it's like, again, it's just like this immediate confirmation that this is like, you're on the right track. And then, dude, we were reading more of it. And then, so his first attack is Rage Wave. Its second attack is called Deep Dive. And then I realized that for the conference, they have lots of speakers at the conference. And on the website, they have you do a description of what your talk is about. And so the description I used was healing from child abuse through meditation, community, therapy, and stand-up comedy, period. A deep dive into the mental and emotional impacts of child abuse and the trial experience. The phrase that I used was deep dive. A deep dive into the freaking child, dude. It was, and we read that, and it was like, oh shit, fuck, whoa, tit, oh my god. It was like a pinging of synchronicities around and around, because this whole sequence is happening because of this conference, and the overview of the whole speech is just that exact thing. Healing from trauma and a deep dive into the freaking experience that the trauma was, and the impacts of the trial experience. A deep dive into that shit, dude. Oh. I mean, it's like, it's just, again, it's like one of those sequences that's just like so, so in your face. This is so obviously good. And like, you know, universal nods, like, hey, yes, absolutely, keep doing what you're doing. And then all of this through Lugia, my favorite Pokemon. I mean, it was just so, so cool. And Rage Wave and Deep Dive, and both of those are literally, I mean, you know, you get it. So, okay. So it continues, of course, it always does. So my mom and Galen and I are just like tripping out, totally sober, just marveling at the unfolding. And then we finish the conversation and, you know, I'm just feeling amazing. And we decide to watch Pokemon 2000. So, obviously, because we need to now. And there's, you know, the whole thing, there's like this one sequence towards the end where basically there's this prophecy that all these birds are going to start fighting and then Lugia has to save the day. But Lugia can't do it alone. Lugia needs the help of Ash. And but the prophecy is like the whole world will turn to Ash, which they interpreted as it being like bad, you know, like will burn down. But they're talking about Ash Ketchum. And so there's a moment where they're like, oh my God, Ash, the prophecy, it's talking about you. And they're like, can you do it? Are you ready to do this? And Ash goes, whoa, hang on. Like, wait a minute. Like, training Pokemon is one thing, but like saving the world, that's like a whole other thing. And then they all like collectively like get together and are like, no, 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 you can do it. Like all the different characters are like, you can do it. You can do it. And all of Ash's Pokemon pop out of the Pokeballs and are like, you can do it. And then they're like, how, what do you think? And Ash goes, well, right now I wish my mom had named me Bob instead of Ash.
And thus the earth shall turn to ash.
But how are we ever going to find the chosen one if we don't even know where to look?
It's right in the legend. The earth shall turn to ash.
Ash, it's talking about you.
I'm the chosen one?
Pikachu.
Wait a minute. Training Pokemon's tough enough, but saving the world is way too hard.
I know it doesn't sound easy, Ash.
But you're the only one who matches the legend perfectly. What do you say?
Well, right now, I wish my mom had named me Bob instead of Ash.
So, for those of you that don't know, my dad's name is Bob. And my grandpa's name was Bob. And my great-grandpa's name was Bob. I come from a line of Bobs. And Ash Ketchum says that. Right now, I wish my mom had named me Bob instead of Ash. And I'm like, immediately, like at this point, Galen had like, we sleep with mouth tape on. By the way, highly recommend it. Really helps with sleep and getting quality sleep. But we were both sleeping with mouth tape on and she had turned over at this point and was just listening. And we both heard this line and we were both like, she like turned over and we both ripped our mouth tape off and we're like, holy shit, dude, this is bananas. Oh my God, what's happening? Because literally, my mom was the reason that I was not named Bob. Because, and I don't, you know, my dad, I don't think was super keen on doing it, on naming me Bob, but that was in consideration. And my mom was the one who was really advocating for like, okay, we should name him something different. And they ended up naming, my middle name is Robert, which is, so all my dad, grandpa, et cetera, they're all named Robert Scales. And so I got the middle name of Robert, but my first name was Sebastian. Sebastian Robert Scales, and freaking Ash Ketchum, dude, he says that. Of all the names. What? What? And, dude, the other thing, it's like, if you combined Bob and Ash, you get Bash. Dude. Which is like, just again, so universally in your face, dude. Right on cue, right on track. Keep going. It was just so epic. Why did they say Bob? I mean, it's like a common name, I guess, but like, and just the fact that it was his mom he's referring to, I wish my mom had named me Bob. It was just that, you know, I mean, intense resonance, dude. Deep. Freaking. you know, and this all ties into all of the feeling stuff that we're talking about like you can feel the synchronicities more and more deeply, more intensely as you allow yourself to feel whatever it is that you're feeling. It's like you put on that synchronicity lens and the lens just keeps getting bigger and bigger and wider and deeper and all this stuff that, oh man, it was just, whew, it was just epic. So that happened. And, you know, also I got like super emotional when all of that was happening, in part because it was like I was, you know, one, feeling this resonation that I had with Ash Ketchum when I was a kid, but also just seeing how this is all connected. You know, that was that movie came out in literally in 2000. And, you know, here I am decades later being like feeling it, feeling the impact of it, and then feeling the impact of it now. And how, you know, I was thinking too, like when I was watching the clips before all of this happened of the movie, and I was feeling emotional at that. It was just interesting being like, I couldn't quite explain why I was emotional. It was just something was resonating. And I think that part of what it is like, in the same way that we can see backwards and see how all of this is connected, you know, time is just, we just fucking made it up, dude. Like, it's just a measurement. And literally, like, it actually, there's never a moment outside of now. So if there's never a moment outside of now, and we can see infinitely back, but like it's all connected. It's just one giant blob of experience that I what I'm trying to say is I feel like it's forward facing too. And I felt like the emotion that I was feeling when I was watching the clips was almost like preemptive emotion of what was coming. I can't explain it yet, but I feel that there's something big here. And it just, oh man, just makes me feel like, yeah, like I can't make a mistake. Like I'm a part of all of this and happy to be. And then also another sequence during that sequence of Ash saying that stuff about Bob, I watched it so many times. And then I noticed that Ash Ketchum wears this red hat, which I'm wearing currently. Galen got it for me a few days after that. And he has this hat. And I remember looking at that hat and pausing and thinking to myself, I don't have a red hat. Like, I'm pretty sure I don't have a red hat. I've never had a red hat. And I would like a red hat. I liked his hat a lot. And then the next day, my friend Richie and Berger, two dear friends of mine, were coming over to do a podcast. And Richie was like, hey man, like I got you a present. And it was this hat. You see this, dude? Literally, it's a red hat, even with like the white in the middle, just like this. He got me this and I was like, holy fuck, dude, this is, I explained the sequence to them. Because I was like, this is literally a thought that I had last night that popped up. And I thought about it again that morning because when I got up, I was like organizing my hats and I confirmed that I didn't have a red hat. But I wasn't like, I need to go buy a red hat. I just thought I would like a red hat. And then I forgot about it. And then here's Richie. He met with a hat company who wants to sponsor him. And they gave him hats. And he was like, I think Sebastian would like this hat. And he brought this to me. Literally within 24 hours of me having the thought, I would like a red hat, it just appears. And I think that that's because there was no resistance in my mind to getting a red hat. It was like, I know that I can have a red hat. I know that I don't need a red hat. It would just be fun to have. But I'm not thinking about getting a red hat in the same way that perhaps I would think about getting a Rolls Royce, which I'm trying to not think about in any sort of stressful, I got to work super hard to get that kind of way. It was just like, there was no associated thoughts of this is going to be super difficult to get. This is going to take a lot of time. I'm going to have to work super hard for this. It was just, I want a red hat. Then I forgot about it. And then it appeared. And I feel like that is what manifestation is in its, you know, in a way easier, flowy way. It's like, rather than wanting a red hat and then attaching to the way that I think that the red hat should come into my experience, I just thought about it, wanted it, and then let go of it completely. I wasn't at all in the vibration of needing it or stressing about it. It was just the vibration of ease, and I'm totally content without it. Wanting is defining yourself as not having. So if you want a red hat, you are not in the vibration of having it. If you have the red hat, your vibration is completely different than when you wanted it. So it feels like all you have to do is just, that's what, like with all this manifestation stuff, when people say like, make your desire known to the universe and then let it go. Because letting go allows you to exist in the vibration of being enough, which is what you need to be in the vibration of in order to have what it is that you would like. But if you stay in the space of just wanting, and I really want this and I don't, I'm defining myself as not having it, so it can't get to you. So you just want and let go of any attachments to how this should happen, including like grinding, you know, like, you know, of course I could have ordered it under a red hat on Amazon, but by not insisting on how this manifestation comes to pass, I allow the universe to work in ways that are more effortless than I can even begin to imagine. Like Richie was the first person that I saw that day, and he's like, here, have a red hat. It's like, dude. And of course he did. When you think about this Lugia sequence, all this rage sequence, the timing of Tobin, all of this stuff, it's like, dude, it's just, it's so infinite. It's so infinitely, brilliantly connected that we can trust that. We can trust that infinite intelligence that we also are. There's no part of us that isn't part of that. And, you know, we can trust that fully and let go of any part of ourselves that doubts that, you know, that you are all of it. That you are worthy of it. You know, there was no part of me that's like, I'm not worthy of the red hat, which also would have been defining myself as in that vibration of not having it. There was no resistance in my reality, so the hat showed up as quickly as possible. And for free, also, effortlessly. Talk about, it's like it didn't even come in, it's not even, it doesn't even cost anything. You don't even have to try. All you have to do is release the beliefs that tell you that you do have to try, that you have to grind or whatever, and be open to being surprised. And I told them this whole sequence, Richie and Berger, and it was like, oh my God, this is so cool, dude. What can't we do? What can't we have? If I think that a Rolls Royce is hard to get, that's my reality. That's the lens I have on. And if I say I want a Rolls Royce, a purple Rolls Royce Phantom, which is what I want, but don't need, and as best as possible, releasing any resistance to the difficulty of receiving that, who's to say that isn't going to show up in my experience in ways that are easier than I can imagine? It's just so fun, dude, all of this. Oh, man. So let's see. That was like recently. Okay, let me see where I'm at here. Okay, literally exactly an hour. That's awesome. So I guess we can just roll right into the next stuff then. So basically the sequence of preparing for the conference after that whole rage sequence was just so fun and effortless, dude. It was so easy. Because I wasn't putting any of these conceptual burdens on myself. I didn't need to memorize it. I knew that I was going to be okay. I was even realizing I can talk about this rage sequence in the speech. you know, I didn't have time to probably get into all the Pokemon card synchronicities, but just talking about how this is an ongoing process. You know, I didn't want to present it as like, hey, I'm all good forever now, guys, because things are always happening in our reality that we need to feel and need to heal from. And this was like the perfect example of something that literally happened as I was preparing for the conference that I could talk about. And so I did. I added that rage sequence into the whole speech and basically set up a PowerPoint that was, you know, and that's another part of it. It's like when you do stand up, you don't have any notes generally or like a PowerPoint to look at. And just sort of having the PowerPoint, it was like, oh, this is so helpful. And I just, with each passing day, as the conference got closer, I got more and more comfortable with whatever it was that was going to happen. I was just feeling good about everything. Like, and every moment that I felt good was a moment that I wasn't creating resistance. I wasn't, you know, creating beliefs that made me think that this was potentially going to be bad or hard or whatever. And, yeah, okay. Now that I'm realizing this, I'm like, okay, I have so much to say about the conference and everything that happened. So I'm actually going to record it. This is going to be part one. And I'll do the part two another time because I also know that I don't have that much memory on this. Anyway, not super essential to convey. And yet I did. And it's completely fine. Everything's fine. Everything's great, dude. I'm keeping that lens on forever. And if I forget, that's fine. I'll put the lens back on when I remember. So yeah, dude, just absolutely in love with reality, and I'm just so stoked. I literally say this all the time, and I know that. And maybe I don't even need to keep prefacing this with that with this. It's okay. But thank you so much for listening and watching this, and I'm just so, it's so fun to be able to chat about these synchronicities with you. And I find this all just to be so expansive, and I'm very happy to be a vibrational match with you, because that's what we are. We're vibrationally matched. If you're here, dude, we are absolutely just so aligned, and I'm grateful that we are. So thank you, and I'll see you in part two. Yes. I hope you're having a terrific time in your reality, and that it just keeps getting better and better and better, and it just literally can just keep getting better forever. And it seems to be, and it feels really good. Okay. All right. Love you guys. See you in the next one. Peace.
Woo! Lugia! Lugia!
I wanna be the very best. No one ever was. To catch them is my real test. To train them is my...